He's Jim Browdy.
And she's Marjorie Egan.
And this is Boston Public Radio.
89.7 WGBH, WGBH HD1 Boston.
Online at WGBHnews.org.
Boston's local NPR. Welcome back to Boston Public Radio. Jim Browdy and Marjorie Egan joining us as they do every month. Actually, that's the most ridiculous thing. Joining us as they do every Monday, except when there's a snowflake in the air, to talk through the moral dilemmas of the day are Reverends Emmett Price and Irene Monroe.
Are you saying we're flaky?
Reverend Irene Monroe, that was the voice you just heard, is a syndicated religion columnist. Reverend Emmett Price is a professor of music at Northeastern University. Thank God it didn't snow. Good to see you both.
Amen.
Well, I'm glad to be here, but I just need to say I suffered from post-traumatic snow disorder. I certainly did. But I had a conversion experience being snowbound.
How so?
Okay, you want to hear it?
You listened to the show without you.
Well, listen, I decided I wasn't going to let you folks get my Pope dander up.
Beautiful. Well, we're going to do that in a little while.
Very good. Okay, very good. Well, we're glad there was no snow blizzard. It wasn't a few flakes. It was a blizzard when they couldn't make it. So they get some.
Wait, excuse me. On those days, did you get to WGBH? I can't remember.
Well, I did.
Well, so did I.
This is like my full-time job.
Oh, I see.
I mean,
okay, fine.
You know, you can't expect Irene and Emmett
that's
to be traversing
you.
Oh, yes, you can.
I'm a fair weather minister.
Exactly.
Anyway,
thank you.
Right?
Let's get it going here.
So I want to talk a little bit about Selma. Emmett Price, you were very prescient. You wrote something having to do with Selma a few weeks ago. What'd you say?
I did. I said that it's very difficult to tell any story about African Americans or black folks without the musical soundtrack. And I think one of the things that made the Selma movie so effective was that the musical backdrop was just absolutely awesome. And I think that the great original composition, Glory, which we saw performed last night at the Oscars, and they won an Oscar, was absolutely right on the money.
You know, I'm embarrassed to say, Marjorie and I saw it when they had the big event with all the muckety-mucks, the pals, and all that sort of stuff. Who are some of the other performers, and what are some of the other songs other than Glory, which now all of us have come to know pretty well?
Well, I mean, you had moments. You had Odetta. You know, you had, of course, Precious Lord, which was sung in the movie awesomely by Ledisi Young, who's actually an up-and-coming. I mean, she's actually not. She's a phenomenal R&B soul singer. Great, you know, made popular by Mahalia Jackson. But you also had some blues songs and some, you know, staple singers and, you know, all the characteristic sounds.
A mixture of genres.
Yeah,
and the interesting thing about it, this really is the new sort of social justice anthem in a way, because it's intergenerational. And
this being Glory or the whole
Glory? Yeah. Well, Glory, but the Glory in particular, because as it's reaching back, it moves forward with a new generation of people. But it also lifts the voices of women in a way that
absolutely.
We have not heard before.
Absolutely.
It is just a spectacular. And to see the props was beautiful. To see the stage, you know, walk across the bridge really brought that moment back.
By the way, if you missed it last night in an otherwise thoroughly undistinguished 11 hours or whatever it was, here's John Legend performing Glory, obviously from the movie. And afterwards, you'll just hear a little bit. We played some of this earlier of his fabulous acceptance speech for Best Original Song. Here it is.
When the war is won,
glory.
When it's all.
We wrote this song for a film that was based on events that were 50 years ago, but we say that Selma is now.
That's right.
Because the struggle for justice is right now.
Well, anyone ever see him? But I saw him at the Orpheum with my younger daughter a couple of years ago. Eighth row. He is really,
he is
a word I never
used. And this
awesome.
Song is like We Shall Overcome Part 2.0.
Yeah.
I mean, it's going to have that effect in terms as we look forward, and it's being used already around the world.
It is, actually. I didn't know that.
Yeah.
Absolutely, which is part of the great hashtag March On in terms of using it for social justice and for equity movements across the world.
Do you think the movie got the shaft?
Oh, absolutely. But you know the very interesting thing. Of course, you're asking Irene, right?
Exactly. As soon as she asked, looking at you, I said, why are we doing this?
Absolutely. But it's more than a modicum of truth. It really is what actually happened over something you know, as silly as the politics of the film. But the interesting thing is, and I was listening to a black news radio station this morning, News One, with Roland Martin. And the interesting thing is, and I felt this way too, I felt like, and I talked with Emmett about this as well, I felt they were throwing us a bone. And
who's they?
The Academy.
Oh, I think it's clear.
And what was so egregious was what I called the tsunami of black folks that were either presenting or was part of, you know, a crowd
the
scene.
The president of the Academy, which no one knew before.
And it's sort of like doing what SNL is like, we see black folks.
Yeah.
We have black folks. So I thought that, and the very interesting thing is I felt like they only saw black folks because I didn't see Asians, I didn't see Latinas other than J-Lo. So again,
You saw all of J-Lo too, actually.
Right. Well, you're probably right. Maybe too much of her, but nonetheless.
The big problem is that Ana DuVernay should have been nominated for Best Director,
yes.
And David Oyelowo should have been
screenplay
and for you know, he should have been for Best Actor.
You know, I'm just as a quick aside, I'm glad you brought up crowd shots, Irene, because I always think when you have a politician, especially a pretty conservative politician, and there's 75 white people on the stage, and then he has like two or three strategically placed black people, I always think to myself, they must know that this is just that this is just like I'm getting hauled up here.
No, wait, it's better than politicians. How about when the University of Michigan, we did a show on this years ago. They sent out
their brochure. That's right.
It was all white people. And I'm going to get this slightly wrong, but the gist of it is right. It was all white people, you know, like 100 white faces. Then all of a sudden they realized, oh, my God, this isn't going to work. And they essentially Photoshopped the thing to plop some black and Latino
faces. Well, it's photo op moment. That's
right.
It's sort of like they have this white out. And then all of a sudden they look at the photo and they go like, what's wrong with this picture? And probably they're saying nothing is wrong, but the political correctness of it suggests we might need at least a couple of flies in this bowl of milk.
Well, I mean, the problem is I can tell you right now where all the black people sat last night. I mean, if we put a stage chart, I could tell you who sat right. Oprah was right next to Stedman, behind
Eddie
David
Murphy
Right.
Tell you something?
I didn't know Stedman was still on the picture.
At least for public moments. Let's just say that much.
Can I one positive spin on this? Because I think I agree, and I think Marjorie does too, that the film deserved far more recognition than it got. Most people don't remember which film won Best Picture. No, they really, I mean, I don't, at least.
Really?
This song, and I agree with you, this song is going to live on. I didn't even know about it. It's spreading around the world now, but this song, I hate that expression, has legs, but it really does. This has a lot of future. Speaking of history, and obviously Selma depicted a history a century ago, there were remembrances, Boston, New York, and elsewhere, and I have to say, not huge, which sort of surprised me, commemorating the 50th anniversary of the assassination of Malcolm X, and his daughter going out of her way to both write and say, I want my father to be remembered in a way other than that which mainstream media is portraying him. Emmett, starting with you. Is she right? And what is the misperception that a lot of us have 5 decades after the fact?
Yeah, she's absolutely right. And I'm so proud of her for doing this. She's the third daughter. She was 2 years old when he was assassinated in the Audubon Ballroom. And she was there. Right. And so she has this understanding that the person who we iconize as Malcolm X was not who Malcolm X was when he was assassinated. Right. It took him 38 years to deal with the tension of his family, of his upbringing, of his history, of his pathology. And in that last year, he had made a tremendous transformation.
And
right?
even before that, I think, you know, the interesting thing is, and I was so glad that she sort of brought this up because she wants us to remember her father and also his legacy. But the very interesting thing is that he's frozen in time. Similarly, I must say, to MLK.
Right.
That we have just one iconic image, one just sort of one-dimensional image. And this man really blossomed into just a remarkable, public intellectual, you know, on the issue of not just black rights, but of human rights
across. International.
And the thing is, he left the Nation of Islam, which, you know, people have various feelings about that religious group, to become a Sunni Muslim, a much more progressive thinking even about Islam. And one of the things I always wonder, particularly since he was a Sunni Muslim, what would he think now in terms of what's going on in the Muslim world?
So how should he be remembered? I mean, every school kid learns about Martin Luther King far from every school kid learns anything about Malcolm X. What should they learn about him?
They should learn that he had the courage to change, that he had the courage to transform his thinking, both internally and externally, and that what he projected at the end of his life was more about love and healing, more about, you know, collaboration and partnership, and really more about what it would take for this world to be the world that we all envision it to be. Irene made a great point. In the history books, we see them usually in a black and white photo, which makes them look around 50, 55 years old. Both of them were assassinated at the age of 39.
Right.
Never
yeah.
made it to 40.
Yeah. Yeah, and I think one of the things that I think I would like for folks to remember in changing Malcolm X, because at one point there was this trending of Malcolm X, and it was the hoodlum Malcolm X that
right.
young African-American men were appropriating, that he's a classic example that you can really turn your life around. And it's sort of cliche, making a way out of no way. Mm-hmm. And even though he was still marginalized as a black man, and Emmett and I were talking about this in the green room, that although America was not ready for Malcolm in his day, they still wouldn't be ready for Malcolm even today.
What do you mean by that?
Well, largely because he's outward thinking. Black man, and he talks about, his daughter talks about it, the kind of systemic change that must take place. And one of the things that she sort of condemns about the Ferguson movement is that while it's wonderful on rhetoric, she felt like there wasn't enough done around, you know, keeping the movement alive
yeah.
and the structural changes. She even says the whole notion, you know, hands up, don't shoot, is a very, very, you know, sort of demeaning stature to take as a people that are trying to really actualize power.
You know, speaking of the first, oh, I'm sorry, Margaret.
I was just going to say, she's got a great line in here, and this was an op-ed piece she wrote in the New York Times, saying, today when people speak about how we must fight racism, the threat feels empty. We have softened to the point of apathy, and everyone is so easily distracted from activism by pop culture and high-tech consumerism. And everyone can relate to that, I think.
Well, I mean, you know, everyone's doing the hands-up shirts and the can't-breathe shirts. And earlier, in an earlier segment, you guys talk about who were the people who spoke truthfully. Whether we agreed or disagreed with them, who are the people who had the courage to speak mm-hmm. how they felt, regardless of a platform. And I think he's one of those individuals. Again, whether you agree with him or not, or like him or not, he spoke what was on his mind, and he was a nurturer and
about
educator.
Stuff that I think that would not change, because one of the things is Selma is about voting reform.
Yeah.
And one of his Malcolm's really renowned speeches is the ballot or the bullet.
Mm-hmm.
So again, as much as that, it's 50 years since, you know, his assassination, we've incrementally improve, but certainly not enough.
And one of the things, Irene, I know you'll love this as a big feminist, that he was ahead of his time, because one of the breaks with the Nation of Islam was over the head guy sleeping with these teenage girls. He did
yeah,
not.
But you know what? He was a bit of a misogynist himself, but absolutely he was calling Elijah Muhammad on all that baby mama drama. Okay,
yeah.
that he certainly.
You know,
was,
didn't hear much of that complaining from a man about other men in that back in the.
But you know what? I'm suspect, because I really felt that was one of his ways of about. It was more to me about power, and the best way to sort of dethrone Elijah Muhammad was to do a character assassination,
okay.
because he wasn't any different than anyone else. I really felt that this was more about Malcolm's ego and hunger for power than it was about being righteous about him being a baby mama kind of guy.
You know, one second before I move on here, you mentioned her. The daughter's criticism of the so-called Ferguson movement. I haven't thought much about this, at least since last week. Has the Ferguson movement been totally derailed by snow? And I don't mean that facetiously.
No.
I mean, the East Coast, what are we hearing today and yesterday and the week before?
We're trying to dig out.
No, but I'm serious.
Yeah.
When you both said no emphatically,
the movement continues, because if you look at a lot of the college campuses who are having panels and forums, you have a lot of representatives from now the kind of Ferguson movement kind of organization.
And there's stuff still on the line that is very on internet that is very, very bright, vibrant. And this is the way in which many of us have been snowed in, have kept in
Fine.
Touch with the movement and stuff.
Okay. We had David Axelrod. Why don't you tell the story, Marjorie?
Well, we had David Axelrod on last week because he's written this new book called Believer about his association with Barack Obama, of course. And the Washington Post has a piece in The Fix talking about Axelrod getting wrong gay marriage in the black church. The conventional wisdom during Barack Obama's candidacy was that he did not come out in favor of gay marriage, even though he may have been in favor of it, in part because of the opposition, the black church being so strong. This writer says that Obama and Axelrod were wrong about that. So I'm wondering if I missed something.
Wrong about what? Opposition
to the black church to gay marriage being very strong. You guys are both reverends. Is the black church come around on this?
Not even today. It's rabidly homophobic.
So you're not buying this at all?
No, absolutely. I mean, if anything, what the black church did, it was this theological qualify that I call love the sinner and hate the sin. And then
that's what the Catholics say. That's the same thing the Catholics say.
Oh, okay. I guess they're kissing cousins, no pun intended.
Yeah, I think it's broader. I think it's broader than the black church. I think with societally, it's one of those situations that you can, have an analogy to mental health, right? Everybody has, or not everybody, a lot of people have people in their family who are suffering from mental health, but you don't really publicly talk about that, right? And a lot of people, right, have people who are gay, lesbian, transgender, bisexual, you know, whatnot. And a lot of people are allies, right? But you don't publicly talk about that. And the church has not created a platform or a position in order to do that. One, because the black church is an ecumenical church with a lot of denominations, a lot of structural challenges, and there is no one voice.
Wait.
There's no one voice.
Well, yes, it's monolithic. Comes to gay issues.
No.
And the interesting thing is, as much as that, and it's a church that is truly on the down low, it makes me think that they do have something going on with the Catholic Church, because a lot of those brothers, and we can name them and we know them, and some are very well known, are homosexual themselves. So, I mean, they're very, very conservative. And the problem that keeps that kind of rigidity has everything to do with sometimes the way in which tradition betrays us, because it's saying that this is how we've done it before and this is how we keep it. But what has happened that because of the church's homophobia, we have the largest demographic group that is suffering with HIV/AIDS, suicide, and all the other stuff that comes with a church and a theology that is on the down low.
Let me just understand that. Irene's position is virtually monolithic. I heard you say, no, it's not.
That Axelrod is right, is what she's saying.
Yeah, but how in 2015, forget when Obama was still evolving and now he's evolved, how much of a monolith is the black church on gay issues, gay marriage, that sort of thing?
Oh, you have outliers. And I don't.
But there are outliers.
Yeah, but I don't want to negate the voices of the outliers, because that's how you have systemic change, by the individuals who have the courage to step up and lead the charge.
That's not working, Emmett. Okay, of course you have the outliers, but those outliers were using the gay issue to really to step up in a power position. They care less about LGBT folks than anybody else, but they use it as a power pawn.
But let me ask you, I'm sorry, go ahead, Emma.
We're about to fight.
I think there's some mothers and fathers and brothers and sisters who are part of the black church
that
who
are
advocate
silent about,
on behalf of their
no,
family members.
No, they do
they
not.
They may not get the chance to talk to the bishop
then
or
who they
the pastor,
to Jesus?
But within the church,
okay.
Right? Because
no.
If you minimize the black church to just the leadership, then you're not talking about anything.
Okay,
you're just talking about a bunch of leaders.
Yeah, but the leadership is maintained by this code of silence. Nobody in the black church says, Reverend, and on any given day, you ought not to have preached that sermon.
Let me just mention that Irene has stood up now.
That's right.
First time ever, by the way.
She's going to lead across the table in a minute.
I'm going to bring my musician with me next time.
So this sounds like you think that the black church is very much like the Catholic church, which is that a lot of Catholics in the
You're
pews...
You're talking Emmett now.
Like blacks in the black church
yes.
pews are very down with gay rights, but the leadership is not.
Yes.
No, that is not true at all.
Okay, that is
oh
not true.
Oh my goodness.
It's true that that's what I think.
Okay, okay. Then I think that Irene really, forget about Pope Watch. She needs to be the Pope of the black church instead of everybody's
standard. Now you got my Emmett dander up, okay?
All right.
Not even the Pope dander.
Well, you haven't been here for a while when we have been talking about the, we've missed you in our revved up segment because of all the terrible blizzards. So has the Pope done anything wonderful or terrible since you've been here that you'd like to tell us about?
Yeah, well, you know, when I was here the last time, I gave him a 3.
You did?
Okay, that's quite a bit of a jump.
On a 1 to 5 scale.
That's
for
right.
New listeners,
and,
yes.
And 3, and the whole reason was because of some nice things he said about women. But the recent incident about what he said about transgender people and that they're manipulating with God's, you know, eternal design.
Yeah.
I mean, you go like,
Yeah. Okay. You I know, think he's not too good on women's issues or children's issues after his spanking remarks.
He's not too good on a whole lot of issues. Why don't we just tell the truth? You know what is what we say? Tell the truth and just shame the devil as well as the Pope on these issues. Really.
So, Emmett, can you give your review of the Pope's behavior in the last month, if you would? Maybe not.
I mean, I think that the Pope should stay away from scientific analysis. I will say that. I'm happy that he invited the New Ways Ministry group to have the VIP seating at the last,
yes.
you know, but he didn't give him a shout out. And so, you know, it goes back and forth. So I'm neutral this week.
No,
I'm
his
neutral.
Conversations, I just have to say, his conversations are very topical. I listened to you, you know, during the time I was snowbound.
Thank
here
you.
And stuff. It was wonderful. And I listened to my editor, Sue O'Connell at Bay Windows.
And
she made a wonderful statement. She says, you know what, we need not to aim too high. But the bar is so low. I mean, I just feel like, what are we doing here? I mean, I think we are enabling very much a nice man, but not a man that has moved into modernity. I feel like we have this battle between modernity and traditionalism.
Yeah. Well, I think it's like the Titanic; it takes forever to turn the ship around. But I do.
No,
think...
but that. But wait. Now that thing didn't that thing sink? What,
it did,
what Titanic
it did sink.
Are you talking about?
That's what he's worried.
What
he's worried
Titanic
about. He's worried about sinking
about
the whole thing.
Oh.
Okay. Anyway, okay.
So we'll see you in the spring, or when will we see you next?
I'll be here next week.
Okay. I'm fair weather.
You two can continue the discussion in the parking lot.
I'm
there.
About to choke
Don't
Emmett.
Hit anybody. Reverend Irene Monroe is a syndicated religion columnist. She's fit to be tied. Reverend Emmett Price, I would advise you to walk quickly. Reverend Price, he's a professor of music at Northeastern University. His latest book is The Black Church and Hip-Hop Culture Toward Bridging the Generational Divide. They join us every Monday. See you later, you guys.
Not
coming
every
up.
Monday, but yeah.
Oh, they don't?
Well, they have. They haven't.
Yeah, okay. Coming up, the temperature is plummeting. It's going to be cold all week. So why is it that you are drinking iced coffee in the winter? Is as bad as going all season without a hat and gloves? Your crazy penchant for coffee is on the rocks next on 89.7 WGBH, Boston Public Radio.